Welcome. Appreciate everybody coming. We are going to talk today about some invited testimony talking about how we can take advantage of all things E, improving the effectiveness of state government, and giving better tools to the employees of our state. First up, let's invite up Vince. Where's Vince at?
He's in the audience.
Oh, there he is. Come on up, Vince.
And do you want Berman with him?
Is Craig? Oh, Craig. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. We're gonna go over some of the recommendations from the Internet Commission. Do we have extra copies of this?
We do have them.
We have extra copies of the Internet Commission.
Mr. Chair, I brought a bunch of extra copies.
Excellent. And we'll welcome. Please introduce yourselves for the record.
My name is Vince Chiappetta. I'm a professor at Willamette University College of Law.
My name is Craig Berkman. I'm in the venture capital business and served with Vince on the Oregon Internet Commission.
Basically, we were asked to come here to give a little bit of introductory context with regard to what the Oregon Internet Commission did, and most particularly a few of the recommendations that came out of that activity. I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the Oregon Internet Commission. We issued our report in January, and as I mentioned it right at the beginning, there are copies of the report available for those that are interested. It's also available on the web. Basic findings from the Oregon Internet Commission. First off, e-commerce is a lot more than just dot-coms. It's a way of doing business. It affects online businesses, to be sure, but it also has a large impact on business-to-business interactions, pear farmers in Medford, Oregon, and service centers in La Grande, Oregon, as well. So that I think to take too narrow a focus on what's going on with e-commerce can be misleading. Second was, it is a tremendous opportunity for Oregon, obviously generates very high-paying jobs, an opportunity to create sustainable growth, replacing some of the difficult industries we've got now, and works very well in a broader and diverse geography. The third was that, in fact, we need to act. Others have noticed these opportunities, and they're well underway, and we need to get moving as well. The basic goal of the Oregon Internet Commission's recommendations is to create a critical path roadmap of how to best get Oregon, all of it, including the diverse groups that constitute Oregon, in a position to participate in a significant way in this opportunity. The report is broken down into five core groups of actions: education and workforce, telecommunications, electronic government, business and legal infrastructure, plus an umbrella idea, which was the Oregon Advantage, which is a way to capture and communicate the key messages and priorities to important constituencies. I'm going to let Mr. Berkman talk a little bit about the education and business infrastructure recommendations, and I wanted to focus on how this relates to the e-government initiatives, and most particularly the things that we're talking about here today. Very clearly, good e-government provides an effective and efficient way to offer government services to citizens, individuals, and businesses. I'm sure everybody's heard a lot about that, and I'm sure you're going to hear a lot more from a lot more qualified people than myself about that, and so I will leave that delivery to the experts. My message and point of emphasis is a little bit different. I would like to focus on how having first-class e-government in Oregon gives us an amazing leverage of the investments that we make in electronic government with regard to Oregon and its citizens' future. We're going to get a lot more out of this, I believe, than just effective and efficient delivery of government services. By way of example, effective e-government is a tremendous learning tool for Oregon citizens. You learn to use and be comfortable with the tools of the new world, increases your confidence and skills. Government, e-government is a good environment for that to happen. It's not just an abstraction. If you need to get a driver's license, you get on and you try to find out how to get a driver's license. And once, in fact, you're successful in getting a driver's license, you feel fairly confident about your abilities to get a driver's license next time. You also feel much more confident about this environment, which until then may have been a mystery, but at this point has now been proven to you as an effective and efficient way of actually getting things done. Before you know it, you're moving from clicking a okay on this more sophisticated topics like paying online and perhaps even digital signatures. The point of emphasis here is that while education is important, and I certainly don't dispute that and wholeheartedly am behind the recommendations of the commission, I believe the things that Mr. Berkman will be talking about, when you educate an engineer, you have one more engineer. When you educate people through use of effective e-government, you have a population who is full now, or creating a state full of players. A second fallout or ramification of good e-government is actually access. If e-government is going to provide efficient and effective governmental services to its citizenry, it has to reach them. And what that does is it forces us to find ways to build that critical last mile connection. That if you're going to get a driver's license online, you need to be able to get online. And government has at its disposal a number of tools which may not be available to others. I mean, not the least of which, of course, is not having to worry quite as much about the cost-benefit efficiency of getting a return on the investment in money, but rather in services that are being provided by the government. But as well, they have the availability, for example, of libraries or more dispersed government resources as ways to build that access. And miracle of miracles, if you have to get online and are able to get online to get your driver's license, you can also get online to do a lot of other things. The third is really a combination of the ability to pilot, demonstrate, and promote a message, which I think is important to Oregon. E-government, for it to be effective, needs to be good. It's got to work on high standards. It's got to provide a vehicle that, in fact, shows what can be done and how it can be done. And that, again, has the fallout of seeding ideas to others that may not have thought about it. There's nothing like a visible demonstration of success to breed further investment and additional success. It's also a bit of saying beyond, gosh, we know this is important, to, in fact, we believe it's important because we're actually doing it. And so there's a message, I think, to industry and others that Oregon understands the importance of these new technologies, knows how to work with it, and is engaged and willing to work with others. I guess I would close with a few additional thoughts about e-government and making these things come true, recognizing the value of the investment, both in terms of delivering effective and efficient services, as well as getting these other leveraged benefits for Oregon's citizenry, is only part of the deal. In order to make it work, we're going to have to, in fact, do a few other things. One, we're going to make sure that we get first-class outcomes. That means we're going to need to make sure we put in place a proper infrastructure. That means that our environment should facilitate rather than impede the operation of effective e-government. That means getting rid of legacy issues, both legally and technologically. Existing regulations shouldn't require you to change what is already an electronic blueprint into a paper form in order to be able to submit it for record keeping. We ought to be able to do the whole thing in electronic form, which means we may need to look at the regulations that currently exist and modify them to help facilitate effective e-government. In addition, you need to be able to pay the government online. So we need to make sure that, in fact, you can pay for your driver's license the way you can pay for other things. And in addition, when you think about the last mile, it would be nice if whatever you connect at the other end is, in fact, compatible with what it is that's being run from the e-government services on this end. Second thing, with regard to first-class outcomes, going to need user-friendly designs. Needs to be easy for people to use so they can, in fact, learn how to use it and transfer their knowledge. That implies maybe some kinds of standards. Certainly, it implies universal accessibility and universal design in order to foster the desired outcomes. The third thing related to first-class outcomes is we're going to need to generate a high degree of confidence in the e-government systems. That mandates requirements of excellent security and concerns about privacy, so that we need to, in fact, make sure that technically and legally that the e-government systems are, in fact, going to be able to deliver what they promise. Secondly, we're going to need an effective implementation process. That means it needs to be coordinated, needs to be a focused effort with a strong sense of mission, excellent leadership, and clear purpose. Ought to be people working together, avoiding unnecessary duplications and inefficiencies. And we're also going to need a few quick wins. It'd be a good idea to focus on some high-impact initiatives to lead the way. High-impact, I mean, on all fronts, both in terms of value of effective and efficient delivery of government services, as well as the learning curve, visibility, and connectivity. And lastly, we're going to make sure we've got the appropriate resources. Do we have the appropriate talent, time, and money allocated to getting it done properly? All of these are by way of emphasizing that if we do e-government badly, we will get exactly the opposite effect of having done it well. That if we don't make the appropriate investments, if we don't do it in ways that, in fact, are going to generate the right lessons. People are smart. They learn whatever they're taught. If they learn, in fact, that this is something to be feared, that doesn't work, that's very difficult to do, that's the message they'll come away with. So I leave you with the conclusion. I wouldn't presume to go any further on the details. There are far greater experts in the room and elsewhere than I. But I would like to leave you with the thought that investing in e-government, I think, is good not only for the fact that it will provide efficient and effective delivery of government services, a cost-effective way of running the government, but it also has far more profound effects on the future of Oregon and its citizens in the ways that I have outlined it. So suffice it to say, I'm in favor of investments in e-government. I believe it holds a lot of promise.
Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chupera. And this is you've appeared in front of me a couple times, and I guess as this committee has moved through the session, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot during the interim as well. But one of the, I think, as I struggle with the budgets and look at the IT budgets across the spectrum of state government that we wrestle with, I guess the question that I have and wonder if the committee addressed was one of the largest barriers, I think, to creating some enterprise solutions for e-government to work across state government as a whole to deliver services, I think, in a much more efficient manner, is the nature and structure in which we design government, which in and of itself creates many barriers to dealing with and delivering electronic e-government solutions. And, you know, companies have addressed, private business has addressed that in many different fashions, whether it be to make a CIO who is on par, who can knock heads together of various division directors and managers and things like that. But kind of my frustration in looking at state government and in structuring state government is we have individual silos of state government fighting with each other over a pool of money. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we have three separate but equal branches. We just wrestled with that, and Justice Carson is sitting behind you. With the judicial IT budget in front of this committee, I'm wondering, did the committee address that? How high a level should we hold someone in a government setting, and in looking out across the 50 states, what's been the most effective kind of solution to bring the various pieces of state government together to create some enterprise solutions? That's the largest barrier that I continue to see, and maybe Mr. Berkman can comment on that when it comes time to him too, because I think that is critically important, and I'm interested from the private sector side in hearing thoughts that you may have on that particular issue.
I wish I had a terrific answer for you, and the fact of the matter is I don't. I mean, we had limited time and resources in putting together the report. Nonetheless, if you look at the e-government subcommittee report, I know that people on that subcommittee actually did look at some of those issues, and I think that you'll find that while it's not a comprehensive solution, a lot of it does focus on this need for making sure that whatever's behind the wall is not going to cause trouble on the other side of the wall, and so that the kinds of suggestions that are made in terms of recommendations are single portal, for example, so that while you allow a particular branch of government or area of government or administrative agency to govern their content, which they need to be able to do, that's their area of expertise, that they are at the same time made sensitive to the fact that somebody using their site is also going to be wanting to access a number of other sites, and that they may need to be able to get through e-government in a way that is organized and efficient for them as a user. And so that, in fact, I think the primary word in the subcommittee report was user-centric. And so that while you're absolutely right, and very clearly, as we talked about the issues, we recognize the problems, I think that the one place, and the reason I was emphasizing strong leadership here and the need to be working together rather than to counter purposes, is exactly to your point. And I think the way you do that is you recognize the differences, but a lot of them are behind the wall. They're things that government sorts out because its function is to deliver efficient and effective services to the citizenry. In front of the wall, it ought to look and feel as though it is a single delivery mechanism. So ideas like single portal standards for the way, in fact, the user interface works, the ability to accept payments, the nature of the regulations, those things, I think, can be done across the board.
Representative Patridge.
But I guess as a follow-up, what I'm really trying to get to is to get some people to maybe step out a little bit and say, in looking at our structure and how we are structured in the state of Oregon, and I know Ann Terry is new and been brought on board, and Mike Greenfield is now at DAS, but we have a lot of new people since this report came out. But my question is, do you believe, maybe individually and not speaking on behalf of the commission, do we have the ability within the structure of state government now to force agencies and people to come together to develop enterprise solutions that are going to effectively deliver cost? Or do you think we're going to still, or do you have a suggestion on how we organize ourselves so that we do have some accountability, that we have full credit and ability to do some of these things?
I guess speaking personally, what I'd say is we've got the ability. The question is whether we have the will. And I think it really comes down to that. Can we, in fact, do this? I think the answer is yes. Should we do this? I think also the answer is yes. And that's going to mean that people are going to have to step back and say, what is it that really matters here? And how many of these barriers are real, as opposed to ones that are either there because they are legacy, or they're there for some other reason, which, in fact, ought to cede to the importance of these other things. Beyond that, I will absolutely admit that I am nowhere near qualified or informed enough to offer you any specific suggestions.
Thanks.
Greg, it looks like you want to answer.
Well, if I may just add a footnote in response to your question.
Greg, can you put your name on the record?
It seems to me that we need to be looking at this discussion in the context of not just that Oregon is sort of in a vacuum. We're operating in a very competitive environment, and there are other states, including the federal government, that needs to move aggressively into this arena, because if we don't, I think we run the risk of being not only severely adversely impacted, not only financially, but we become sort of retarded in our ability to bring our citizens along into the 21st century. I would make two just tangible, specific suggestions in response to your question. I would leverage what the state has as state government with private industry. There are companies like Compact and Arthur Anderson Consulting and IBM, and it goes on and on, who have a tremendous amount of expertise and a commitment to try to help state governments, municipal governments, come to grips with these issues. And I think they've already made substantial commitments financially and human resources to help make that transition perhaps workable and understandable. And secondly, I would suggest that you might find one or two specific pilot projects to demonstrate that, in fact, it is possible to do something that's state-of-the-art within state government over a time frame that you can measure in very tangible results. And I'll just offer one up as a possible suggestion. If you think of the purchasing function of state government, whether it's buying paper clips or whatever, and think of that as a private exchange, and it offers enormous opportunities, potentially, not only for cost savings and better purchasing for the state, but very measurable results as a consequence. Let me give you one private industry example of where I'm going. One large corporation has about 35,000 vendors that they now work with in supplying them all sorts of component parts as they build out their products. It's estimated by the director of purchasing for that company that they currently expend close to $10 million in pulling down credit reports from organizations like Dun & Bradstreet and others to make sure that the vendors who are supplying much-needed parts for them are economically viable, have the resources to deliver, et cetera, et cetera. And there now is a mechanism that this corporation has discovered, interestingly enough, developed by an Oregon company, that would basically move that cost to that corporation off to their vendors at $180 per vendor per year. And in signing up for some kind of self-disclosure mechanism coupled with other kind of data that's out there, those vendors, as a condition for doing business with that corporation, will be in a position to have the certification or a registrar authority that would allow them to then move forward into not only negotiating contracts, but then perhaps insuring against both parties could insure against this in terms of risk mitigation, where there's a component for the insurance industry to make this thing all work more effectively and efficiently. It's still being worked out in this particular company's, but they estimate that the savings to them could be in the, literally the tens of millions of dollars per month. I don't know how many vendors the state of Oregon has, for example, but if, in fact, it runs into the thousands, and you think about the human resources that are required and the mechanisms by which they make these kinds of detailed risk assessment and mitigation, I think there may be an opportunity, if you just look at that one piece as a way to kind of bring about some tangible examples addressing your question on the one hand and the observations that our chairman has just made in his testimony.
Craig, could you put your name on the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Craig Berkman.
Thank you.
Thanks. Craig, talking about higher ed.
Well, the state of Oregon, again, in terms of its higher education and in terms of its job creation, does not live in a vacuum. We are bordered on the south by a colossus called California that gives us more headaches than it does, particularly with the energy situation, than we would like. But they have made, through the years, and continue to make substantial investments in higher education, both at the private level and at the state level. And the same thing is true to our neighbor to the north. The Washington State's system of higher education continually enjoys very strong funding, both at the state level, and that's reflected in part, too, by the kinds of grants that their institutions get from the federal government and private industry. So what we do or don't do here is not being done, again, in a vacuum. Our view is that Oregon has historically disinvested in public higher education, particularly when it comes to the technology sector, and if we do not do something rather dramatic over the near term, we really put at risk our ability to offer quality jobs to our high school graduates, to offer quality education for them, which in turn will be attractive to industries that are already here, let alone those that we might wish to attract to provide for the quality of life for many of our citizens. Specifically, when the good news is when our state's largest employer announced a few months ago that they were going to hire about another 1,800 people at an average wage fully burdened at $100,000 per year, a lot of people said, gee, that's really great. The negative was that the spokesperson for that corporation said, regrettably, 80 to 85% of those individuals would have to be imported from outside of the state of Oregon because we're not educating enough well-trained people, men and women, through our state system of higher education. That is a fact. That is a reality. That corporation, like this state, competes worldwide. And if that corporation is to succeed in its mission, it can't do so without a high-quality workforce. We have another dilemma, I think, that we face, and as your committee faces, not only in terms of looking at it in terms of higher education, but the investment that consistently this legislature has made through K through 12. We have kind of a schizophrenic K through 12 outcome in the state of Oregon. On the one hand, we have the best performing students on average in SAT scores over the last 5 years of any state in the union. It's something we should justifiably be proud of. On the other hand, we also have some of the highest dropout rates in our secondary schools in the country. But of those that succeed, how many of those students stay in Oregon to get a higher education? And if a lot of them, in fact, the majority of them, are leaving the state and, in fact, never come back, then does it make sense for we, the taxpayers, to spend billions of dollars over a 12-year period of time to give them a first-rate K through 12 education, only in a sense to get no return on that investment because they go and live elsewhere and go to work elsewhere and pay taxes elsewhere? And in essence, we're subsidizing the workforce of every other state in the country. That makes no sense to me. So in the context of looking at how we address these kinds of issues, and with the report in the Oregonian today that clearly high technology is basically the largest and fastest growing employer in the state, how do we address some of those issues? And it seems to me that hopefully, given the tight constraints of the budget, you'll find a way to relieve that. The corollary to that then is, what does that mean for jobs? And as we looked at the infrastructure in the state and looked at trying to find ways to, in a tangible manner, bring all aspects and geographic locations and communities of our state together, it dawned on us that we might be able to turn what some people think is a disadvantage i.e. we don't have a sales tax, into an advantage. And the more we've looked at this, we're one of a very few number of states that has no sales tax. And we're one of the probably the only state in that category that has a infrastructure that is pretty much in place that would allow us to take advantage of being the only real, authentic aspirer to the concept of the e-commerce capital of the country. We have one very specific company in Oregon that we could look to as a model as we go forward. And that's a company called 800.com in Portland that happens to sell home consumer electronics. Many people have said the dot-com craze is over. Well, the good news is that the amount of e-commerce that took place in the fourth quarter last year was in the billions of dollars, and it's estimated to grow on a going forward basis. If Oregon could become, in fact, the e-commerce place in the country, what does it mean? It means that you have to have your fulfillment here. That's why 800.com, in part, can basically sell their goods and services to people in California, New York, and Florida, and they pay no sales tax. So fulfillment means what? Fulfillment means warehousing. That's industrial real estate. Some of the highest-paying blue-collar jobs in America are warehouse jobs. There's a transportation component to this. Fortunately, thanks to the investment Oregonians have made in the past, we have terrific airport facilities in places like Klamath Falls and North Bend and Redmond and Pendleton, sufficient to get planes in and out of there if they have to take things out overnight. Third, there's a high technology component to this. Yes, there are servers involved. There's engineering, and there's the marketing and all these other kinds of jobs that go along with these kinds of companies. But the point I'm trying to make, in essence, is those companies can be located in many other communities of this state where those kinds of jobs would be very competitive, enhance the opportunities for men and women and youngsters in those communities, and basically reward everybody in the state rather than having most of it located here in the valley. And last but not least, in sort of summarizing, trying to tie these two things together, there's a myth that somehow some of the best students in science and engineering in Oregon sort of come from our bigger high schools. And talking with some of the folks in the engineering schools around the state, and more often than not, the students that are at the top of the class are students who are coming from some of our small public school districts. These are very gifted young men and women, and they're making an enormous contribution in the world of academia. And we just need to be reminded of that. And again, go back and say we're doing some great things, but if we don't take advantage of the investment we're making K-12 and follow through with it in the higher education environment, I think we put the state at significant economic risk on a going forward basis.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Mike, Ann, you want to come up? Welcome.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We took a tour over at DASR MD. Between two and three, very quick walkthrough. And so now we know exactly where the dock is for the pickups to unload the equipment to put into the government VES data center. So no fear to any other agencies. I've seen it. There's plenty of space. And I'll get the map of how to map out all this equipment that's going to go in there. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Greenfield. I'm the director of the Department of Administrative Services. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. This event today is an optimistic, forward-looking event, and happy to be part of it. I think information technology really is the only additional management leverage we've got to be more accountable, communicate more effectively with Oregonians and with each other, and to be more productive and to lower expenses. It's really the last piece of leverage, at least the most current one, that we've got, so it's important. Department of Administrative Services has responsibility for finding technology solutions for state government. We've really been joined by Representative Hill and this committee as allies and as part of the equation for success for state government, and I appreciate that. And we're struggling with many of the issues Representative Patridge raised, although I would parenthetically comment that whatever it is in the organization of state government which is not conducive to automating what we do is not conducive to anything else we do. It's a generic problem that has, and the borders don't stop with the technology challenges. Responsibility for executive branch participation rests with the IRMD, the Information Resource Technology Division. And it's a pleasure for me to introduce Ann Terry, who's responsible for IRMD and who will be making all of these things we've talked about come about in concert with the rest of the state agencies and the legislature. Be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Terry, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. We were asked to come and spend a few minutes talking about where we fit into advancing e-government, and I came with three general statements, but I think there's an interesting conversation that started here with your previous speakers and the questions you've asked, and I want to address those directly. The first thing I wanted to talk about was IRMD's role in advancing e-government and what we're doing specifically and addressing some of the proposals that came out in the Internet Commission's report in our own work, and to talk about how we and IRMD are streamlining business processes to make government less costly, and our role in oversight over planned and prudent investment in technologies and the sharing of technologies and data across enterprise. But I want to focus back on advancing e-government. That's what this event is about, and that's where our interest is at the moment. I was going to come in and say IRMD is leading the charge for advancing e-government within the state of Oregon, but I need to restate that. There are many leaders among the state agencies in e-government, and you've seen them showcased here today. There's some very fine work that has been done in designing service delivery over the Internet. So the challenge is how do we, as an enterprise, present ourselves a single citizen-centric face in Oregon rather than separate silos of endeavor and investment? And that's the challenge. And I think you, Representative Patridge, ask a very cogent question, how do we do that within the structure of state government? And I think we all realize that the challenges of this technology have to do with policy, have to do with leadership, direction, management, funding. It doesn't have very much to do with technology. So I'm going to go off the page on the remarks that I've made to tell you how we're addressing that now and how we've been addressing it since, I would say, last fall. Is there's a general recognition in the state that we can't operate as a silo and be effective. We've seen wonderful examples all around us of states that present government to the citizen, and they don't have to know where they're going. They just need to know, I want to accomplish something with my government. That is our goal, to have that kind of a face. What we've done is through the governor's Information Technology Roundtable, which is represented with 20 of the largest state agencies, department heads, their CIOs. This is the governing body, the body that is going to make decisions about how we as an enterprise leverage our investments, make decisions, operate as the business, the corporation, which is government. Underneath that body, we have a steering committee. And on that steering committee, we have representation from Department of Transportation, Secretary of State, Department of Human Services, Department of Consumer and Business Services, Treasury, Employment, Higher Ed. And we have joined together to create a project where we are sharing resources. That means money, and it means people. And right now, we have a project structure in place. We have three project teams working in parallel. The first thing that you're going to see, the visible thing that you will see by the end of this year, is the Access Oregon portal. That project is being led by the CIO of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. He's got people helping him with the skills that are required. So we have a lot of skills across state government. We have a lot of experience in people who have done this work, but we've needed to bring them together across the silos and focus them in a common purpose. And I really believe that we're doing that, and we're very excited about that. So our goal, back to the steering committee, this committee approach to who's leading the charge. Our purpose is to leverage existing infrastructure and resources in a time of tight resources. We are collaborating is the big word. People, hardware, software, skills. We want to build citizen-focused service delivery. We want to find that pilot project that was mentioned prior that has high impact, and we've got several of them that we can deliver quickly. The top priority, as I said, is the Access Oregon portal. There's the portal project team. We have the operations project team who are taking care of policy and the payment solution, and the technical project team, which is looking at the secure infrastructure to support e-government. Underpinning this is that the agencies will own their business. They own the content. They own their business processes. What is centralized is, out of IRMD, we want to be the utility. We provide the secure infrastructure. We provide the financial transaction. We provide the database of financial transactions. And we provide, for those agencies who do not have the investment in infrastructure in place, hosting facilities for their web applications. The IT Roundtable adopted a model, which is the model that the state of Washington has adopted. There are some important differences, but the model is one, we call it the collaborative partnering model, which means it's basically what I described, IRMD as a centralized utility. State agencies who have investment infrastructure, that means people, skills, hardware, software, applications, if they can meet the standards that we've set through our project work that have to do with security and the common look and feel, the branding for Oregon, they can host their own application. If there's a financial transaction involved, that comes through IRMD. I want to tell you about something that's just happened within the last 3 weeks, which I think is exciting, and it's leveraging what the state of Washington has done. We've had several conversations with them. As everyone knows, they are probably the most recognized state for doing e-government well, early adopters. And we are pledged to borrow, steal, adopt, adapt, everything. It can be processes, policies, contracts, templates, code. And we're working very closely with them to see what we can do to jumpstart and catch up with what they've done. So Mr. Berkman talked about leveraging in the private sector. We're wanting to do that. We are wanting to leverage wherever we can to move this thing forward. To be clear about what our goals are, and I think it will be redundant for me to say them. I think you heard in the testimony before the vision that's in the Interconnect Commission's report about citizen-centric government, adding a new channel, reaching our citizens, having them trust government, finding new ways to do business with us. Those are our goals as well. Finally, I just want to say that we're going to be coming back to your committee the first week of May, we hope, and with this fully fleshed out project plan for e-government, including a schedule, commitments of date, the funding plan, and the date for the first deliverable, which is the Access Oregon portal. So, any questions you have, I'd be happy to answer.
There we go. Now, the first time someone's going to come back and ask for us to raise that $1. We're prepared to double it just by showing up in May.
Okay.
To $2.
We've already spent the $1. So all right. We'll look forward to another one.
Excellent. Representative Patridge.
Thank you both for coming. I guess my question to you is, I'm trying to flesh out a little bit where we're at in state government and what goes on in state government, and what DAS-IRMD's role is. And DAS-IRMD's role in front of this committee, to some degree, has been, they have the project expertise to be able to complete the project. They have, they have a plan in place that we've reviewed, and some of those kinds of things. But in adopting an e-government solution, as I sit on two other Ways and Means subcommittees, plus this Ways and Means subcommittee, or this Ways and Means subcommittee/House committee, I guess part of my concern is, as we approach and we deliver e-government, and I think that that's great that we're focusing first on the single source portal, but my concern is, as we kind of build a timeline and timetables to accomplish the projects with milestones along the way, how does DAS IRMD help prioritize, help us as legislators who have to pass a budget, prioritize which projects? In every budget, I'm seeing something about e-government. But what I'm asking for is, let's step back for a moment and focus on individuals who are the recipients of government services. What are the priority? Where can people most access e-government? And why aren't those projects, why isn't the money front-end loaded to prioritize those projects across state agencies, rather than every state agency? And I know, Ann, you weren't here for the whole building of the budget, and I know Mike wasn't either. But I guess my question is there any move from DAS IRMD or anyone else to create some selflessness among state agencies to create those projects which are going to best serve the citizens first and complete those projects, rather than so many competing parallel projects that we really never meet the end game and we tap DAS IRMD's resources to such an extent that we've slowed everything down, rather than achieving some of the deliverables that Mr. Berkman and Mr. Chiapetta both talked about? We need some successes, I guess, is what I'm saying. And my concern is everyone's competing on this kind of parallel track, and we may never get to the end, and everyone is not of equal value in their e-government deliverables, I don't believe, because some of those services are going to be accessed much more often than others. So can you maybe talk about that?
Mr. Chairman?
I can talk generally, perhaps.
You want to make a comment before you answer?
Yes, I do, if it's all right.
Representative Lowe?
And while you're answering the question, if you don't mind, I'd sure like to know what the state of Washington's experience has been in terms of where their activity is, from the citizen's standpoint, is most of it takes place. I'm also interested in, Mr. Chairman, we took a field trip today. Maybe we should go up and see our sister state and see how they've implemented e-government and the different branches of government. I'm particularly interested in how they've done it in the judiciary. That might be good for us to take a peek at.
I think
might solve a lot of problems.
We could just go into the back of the room and look at it.
Go back. Is that what's back there? Hi, guys. I'd say this.
Chair Representative Patridge, in a generic way, let me just comment broadly, and then Ann can be more specific. State government through a process of general growth and political decisions in the legislative process, which are generally compromises, which respond to interest groups, perceptions about needed state services, and the whole variety of the political dynamic that goes into making these kinds of decisions. To overlay that process with a business model is an attractive concept. However, when the business model begins to run afoul of some of the interests of the people who receive services, those entities which pay fees into organizations such as DCBS, who expect as regulated industries to have that agency keeping up with the money that they pay in, versus an agency which may be a general fund agency, such as the Department of Human Services, then you have sort of competing priorities which are not resolvable exclusively by using a business model. This is a government, as you well know, constructed by compromise, give and take, and the creature that we've created does have silos and boundaries which are not just the result of management deficiencies, while some of those certainly exist, but they are the result of fairly purposeful construction of this entity to meet the needs of various groups of state citizens and interest groups. So I would just make that general comment. I think, though, that we have a commitment from the governor and from Representative Hill and this committee and members of this committee to try to overcome some of that and certainly encourage state agencies, which have to be responsive to the legislature, the governor, vendors, interest groups, and so forth, to begin moving in a way and making the convincing argument that we can organize ourselves more along business lines. But it isn't quite as simple as simply saying applying a business technology or priority to these things, because you begin to get reactions. There are dozens of state agencies which are run by administrative boards and commissions who believe that they have a lot of more independence perhaps than we want them to have. And so I think Ann's done a great job, along with a lot of agency heads who've really stepped forward and begun taking those kinds of risks, to reach across those lines and bring people along. And I think that we have as much of a chance of success with Ann's leadership and her folks and the current group of large agency heads working together with this committee, which is quite a motivator for the things that I think we all want to do. I think we have probably as much chance of success of really making that those steps forward that we need to make. And that's kind of the general overview that I've got. And I think Washington reached that point before we did, and they are more than happy to let us beg, borrow, steal, or do whatever we can do to take their technology. But that's kind of the overview that I've got.
I guess I would say that this committee has not been shy about taking some heat on particular issues when it comes to IT investment. And I guess what I'd like to walk away from is, I know that we can't put a pure business model overlay over the top of where we're at with state government, and we have limitations on federal funds and other funds and some of the issues that go along with that. But I certainly would like to look at the general funds that are being spent on e-government projects amongst the various departments, and maybe prioritize which of those should be done in a more measured fashion. I guess I, and I believe members of this committee, are willing to take the political heat that is necessary in order to accomplish some achievable goals and show other people that things can happen in deliverable services. But I feel like we have such competing interests, and nobody is willing to give up their general fund for this or for an e-government or any other project necessarily, to achieve some modicum of success so that we can continue to build on a successful model. And so I guess what I'd be interested in getting from DAS IRMD, and you're working with the state of Washington and other states, is where is the single site portal being accessed the most? Who's using it? And how then can this committee help align through the budgeting process state general fund resources to accomplish some deliverables that were suggested by Mr. Giappetta and Mr. Berkman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I think that's exactly right. And I think this committee has been an important part of an equation which I think is having the result that you've described. And I think some of what Ann was describing, when you have the CIO at the Department of Consumer and Business Services heading up a team which is beginning to design the very kinds of things that we're talking about here, along with the head of the Department of Revenue, we have attendance from the higher ed folks. And so I think that the message has gone out from this committee. Certainly I'm willing to take heat as a manager, and so
we've appreciated that.
We've sent the message out, and actually, you know what, the heat's not as hot as we thought it might be. I think that generally people do want to do the smart correct thing, and I think in Ann we've got somebody who can bring that together. I don't mean to be overly optimistic or suggest any of what you've talked about is impossible, but I think we're making some progress, but we're making the kind of progress you make in government, which isn't send a memo, get a result. This is more of a work together with folks in a collaborative way, and I think we're doing as well as we've ever done, but we need to do better.
Any further questions? Is there any words in terms of, you know, you're the voice of the governor out to agencies in terms of, you know, the governor has done in the past executive orders talking in the focus area. Do we anticipate in terms of continuing ratcheting down in terms of, I think as Representative Patrick said, sort of prioritizing some of the initiatives where, gee, it would be nice to do all things, but let's just start and get the first one done and do it right, and then we can then focus on the other ones coming thereafter.
Mr. Chair, I think it's incumbent upon us to do the kind of staff work which clarifies what those priorities, what the choices are, and then have a conversation with this committee and with the governor about establishing them. I guess I have to tell you that the degree of organization we had didn't even allow us to display those choices. I think we're now getting to the point where we can at least say, here's what the what they are, and then we can have that discussion.
And just for your edification, and I can't remember whether I talked about it or not, Senator Duncan and I had met with Senator Courtney in talking about getting the three branches of government together and driving that as an interim process through a JLIMTC committee. And we've got staff out working on a joint resolution to charge that committee with that and invite the other two branches together so that we actually get the high-level cooperation. And so not to say that it doesn't exist, but to do it from a let's set the vision of the future where then, you know, the legislature knows what its role is and what its responsibilities are to deliver, and then we've got an answer as to where everybody else fits into that in terms of what they're going to deliver. It may be content, it might be hosting, you know, everybody's going to know what the answer is.
Mr. Chair, the governor and his chief of staff are very supportive of that approach.
Representative Patridge.
I just want to clarify, and I'd like to get from you at some point. I know you guys always hate to come to these committees because we ask you for more stuff, but I think that you probably have this readily available. I'd be interested in, for e-government solutions, if we can get a list of the state agencies or commissions or boards within their budgeting process, identifying those dollars which are set aside for e-government, and identifying then other fund, whether they're other funds, federal funds, or general fund dollar, so we can really get a picture for where the money is being spent on for e-government, because I think that is a viable solution, especially in light of the suggestions that have been made by the Internet Commission and people. And then secondly, I would be interested if you can get from California or Washington or whatever, where they're getting the most hits on their sites, where the public is accessing e-government, so that then we can know, you know, are there adequate resources in those places where people are accessing e-government? Are there adequate dollars there? And can Oregon achieve some of the similar successes in a measured approach? Because we're never going to have the money to do it all at one time. And I guess I'm interested to get to those consumers and deliver those services which are going to be more utilized first.
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge.
Thank you.
We'll get that information for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's call up Ruth Emig and Terry Ted Swisher. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to have computers.
Yeah. Ruth, if you want to give up.
To have this up and running, so I don't know what happened.
They're going to have to reboot. Sorry.
Are you going to get it? There we got something. Progress. Are you starting off, Ruth?
What?
Are you going to start off?
Well, yeah, I was just going to go through.
You want to start, introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Chairman Hill, I'm Ruth Immig from EDS iSolutions. I am an e-business consultant. I want to thank you for having us here today. On behalf of EDS and my colleague, Ted Swisher, we're thrilled to be here and to give testimony to the e-government initiative that you have put forward in the state of Oregon and to participate in this event. EDS has a broad range of experience in both government and the private sector, and given the nature of your the task in front of you and the undertaking of implementing e-government in the state of Oregon, due to the time frame today, we're going to focus on one very significant but defined piece of e-government, which is security, which I know is a top priority for both you and your end users, your constituents, to be assured that the information that they are providing to you, that you are providing to your constituents, is secure, and to ensure their privacy. So EDS has devoted an entire practice that spans all of our other practices, our consulting, our information technology solution, or enterprise-wide solutions that focuses on security. And with that, I'm going to turn our presentation over to Ted Swisher, who is our specialist in security.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you.
I'm Ted Swisher with EDS. Representative Hill, members of the committee, thank you very much for having EDS here today to present to you some information about a very important aspect of e-government, and that's information assurance. This next slide gives an overview by showing in the green area on this slide the projected growth by Gartner Group and others who are looking forward in these areas, and it shows where business-to-business and business-to-government growth over the next few years is going to be as compared to business to your constituents directly. The next slide shows several of the issues that are important to e-commerce. They're not listed in any particular order. They are all important, and I'm sure there are issues that you're looking at across the board. But one of the very important ones consists of the area of privacy and security. The next slide here shows that trust is one of the major issues in these areas. The trust that you, the trust that your constituents, the trust that businesses can have in the application of privacy and security to the information that is necessary for you to deal with. The federal government has passed several pieces of legislation already dealing with financial service reform, dealing with health insurance portability and accountability, and in many other areas where the legislation is expected out this year. On the state government side, the legislation is in many cases matching the federal government, but in many cases it's inconsistent with federal legislation right now. And this, of course, is a problem to business, to your constituents, and I'm sure to you as well. One of the distinguishing features of a lot of this legislation right now is that citizens have to opt into any protections that are afforded. They have to make deliberate choices that their information is going to be protected. There are many things in this whole aspect that businesses must do to protect the information that is of value to your constituents. Probably the most important thing is that they have policies dealing with the privacy issues that are posted for all who deal with those individual businesses can become aware of. And in this way, they can earn the trust of the consumers to deal with e-business in this manner. One of the big changes that is advocated is a change from opting in to e-business and protective measures by the part of consumers to actually opting out of it. The default should be that citizens have a right to have privacy of their own data instead of the other way, and making it something they have to go in and elect to have. Cybersecurity and cybercrime, on the next slide. I think we're back one. Oops, going back.
Sorry.
We have to go back too. The issue of cybersecurity and cybercrime is certainly a very important one in any dealing with e-government. There are many sources of attack. There are many vulnerabilities that the systems have. And it's also important for everybody who is approaching this issue to look at the fact that most of the crime, most of the harm that is done to systems, whether the government or business, comes from insiders. Better than 60% of all problems are with insiders within the organization. Some of the actions that are required are coming up with strong defensive measures to protect the systems that they have, and certainly industry has a very strong role in this. Both business and industry must take actions to invest in security, and they must also be looking at privacy as well. It's not just a security issue, it is the privacy issue. And this has to be done within an environment that considers such needs that of, for example, law enforcement. So there are a lot of conflicting kinds of issues out there, and certainly people will be looking to you to help solve those. At the same time, all of our studies show that your constituents are looking not to give up privacy while they're gaining security in the matter. This next slide shows some of the strategies that can be taken to provide privacy and security in the government. They concentrate not just on network security strategies, which many are doing right now. Many businesses, many elements of government just are assuming if they go out and put a firewall in front of the network, they're going to be protected. But that's really not enough. There's too much sophistication in the attack these days and the vulnerabilities. So those who are concerned with security need to look as well at platform security strategies and application security strategies. Going one step further, security is not a one-step process, not buying a new box out there, not getting another consultant to do something for you and then leave. It is a life cycle process. The process that I know our firm employs stresses assessments of systems, providing protection to the systems, validating through testing again that the protective and security measures and privacy measures that are applied are valid, are good, are what you need. Training is an important part. Continuous training in security and in the use of the applications that people very often mess up, and that causes security problems for you. And finally, completing the circle of monitoring. Next, our last slide just shows some of the people and agencies, both government and business, that EDS has helped in the past. It is a big responsibility. It's certainly something in the form of security and privacy that we would urge you to have people consider when they start the process of building a new architecture for their system. Security and privacy measures that are added on at the end are usually more expensive and are usually less effective than if they are part of the original planning process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Swisher, I agree with you that developing a strategy as we develop the system seems to be, would be the most cost-effective and most thorough way to provide security for what it is that we're about to undertake. And as I look at your information assurance three strategies that you employ, it dawns on me that these strategies are going to be most effective against attack from outside of the system in. Since you told us that 60% of the crime that occurs in systems like what we're trying to put together come from insiders inside the system, what strategies would you employ to protect us from people building their own little bombs within the systems that they're developing, or other attacks that might happen from inside, compromising the integrity of the data or the platform or the applications?
Representative Hill, Representative Lowe, thank you very much. The strategy that generally we advocate is to apply all three strategies at the same time. Much more can be done than just putting one network firewall that is essentially focused externally into a system. Firewalls could, for example, be employed throughout the networks so that you have much isolation within the whole of your network. Another thing that can be done is to go to the stage where you actually put individual software firewalls, which are quite reasonable in price now, and have there are a lot of variations in these, right on the firewalls of some of the most important people with the sources of the most important information in the systems that you have to protect, and putting putting software solutions on the platforms of those who are actually external to the system more than they are internal. A lot of your people are traveling, and they aren't even behind the firewalls that support the network. So by having individual firewalls on platforms, again at a reasonable price and judiciously applied, not necessarily across the board, you're getting the kind of software and hardware solutions that will dramatically make your vulnerabilities more limited. They'll never be gone. Security is an oxymoron. It's never going to be perfect. All you can do is keep applying the measures and testing the measures and having a good life cycle approach to it.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you guys coming out and spending the day with us. EDS has said they will come back and help us when we start talking about HIPAA, as well as the MIMS discussion.
Yes.
And obviously understand other alternatives to our serious problems. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you for having us.
Bob, you want to come?
Did he just say isolate systems? Go to thin client.
Welcome.
Chairman Hill, thank you for having us today. My name is Rob Nybar. I'm with Blue Martini Software. Represented mission critical applications for the last 13 years in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm honored to be here with my my partner Bernard Gutierrez. Great. As Bernard is setting up, let me give a brief introduction and just some general comments about where Blue Martini sees the whole interaction and e-business market going sector going at this place, and some of the best practices that we're seeing in the industry today. First, Blue Martini is a company that builds applications that allow people to interact across multiple channels within organizations, such as websites, wireless devices, through call centers, and through outbound email and campaigning systems, all of those into an integrated enterprise-wide approach. We see the enterprise-wide approach as the latest in evolution in the state of the art, as it gives you a closed-loop view of the effectiveness of interacting with, in your case, citizens. I really liked what Ann Terry had brought up about really seeing the silos of different organizations, and that is one of the things that really hurts all sorts of organizations, of having silos of information, because the interactiveness and the synergy behind that typically is just a silo, and it's very expensive to break out that information or the interactions behind those. And I think that just as we see in the latest evolution is, and perhaps a caution in a general sense, in that I think that the state of Oregon, which I do live in the state of Oregon, did a nice job looking at their vision and identifying their vision of where they wanted to go. And I think they did a very good job leveraging
State of Washington.
State of Washington. What did I say?
Oregon.
Oh, I'm sorry. The state of Washington. Sorry. State of Washington, excellent job accomplishing their vision, giving the resources and tools that were available at the time. And my only caution is to look at what their end objective was, and perhaps the opportunity to surpass what they've done with more state of the our enterprise-wide approach that will give you more efficiencies and effectiveness in systems, and we'd be happy to discuss those with you. I think that the evolution can be measured in two different ways. One is the effectiveness, the other one the efficiency. Let's address the effectiveness. One is there is a evolution or revolution as far as rather have than having systems that are aggregations of data through silos. That provides some value. However, we've evolved past that. We've evolved past that into actually having interactions as opposed to just aggregations, and that's really where the value comes back in. The second one is the efficiency, and really for the first time being able to measure the total cost of ownership and being able to make things predictable that were difficult in the past, such as time to benefit, time to implement, and time to change, to continually keep up with the requests and demands of the citizens within your within the state. What I'd like to do as far as our format is turn things over to Bernard Gutierrez. And Bernard has spent a couple of days going through and giving you perhaps a glimpse and modifying our software of what perhaps a State of Oregon site or interaction site might look like before he begins any questions.
Thank you. Bernard, introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Bernard Gutierrez from Blue Martini Software. What I did over the past couple days is browse around your sites and moved a lot of the information, content, and services into the Blue Martini packaged application platform, which, as Rob mentioned, is an enterprise platform that allows you to aggregate all of this content, personalize it, and allow your users to have a very rich experience in terms of getting them the information and services that they're looking for. So I'll just explain some of the concepts and functionality, some of the features that Blue Martini brings to bear. This is the site I pulled information and once again images from your site to build a My Oregon type of a site where users can come on through a portal and access different areas and different sites. So for example, Blue Martini can use analytics to determine what your most frequently used sites are, what pages people are visiting, and what services and functions people are utilizing it to organize it so that when users come onto your site, they're not presented with all of your services and features, but the most ones that are most relevant, plus the ability to navigate down into the different areas. So for example, within a consistent user interface, you can pull a variety of information, for example, child support payments, Department of Transportation, and host it in a consistent look and feel and presentation so that your users are only a few clicks away from the actual information they need. A few clicks away from the most relevant information, but the ability to drill all the way down to access any information that is hidden. So any information can be pulled in and presented in a portal environment so that when users come online, they can access information from a variety of sources and organizations within the state and link the information to provide a more cohesive set of information for the users. So they may be using analytics to bring up the top-oriented sites. You may also have featured links, legislative branch, some quick hits, commuter links, different areas within the site that people can come into. You may also be hosting things such as calendars and information that people can call online and find out about different events and services. This is a very quick way to, once again, provide a lot of value to your consumers without actually having to know who they are. When they come online, you take the most relevant content from the different areas and present that to the end user to allow them to navigate. But to allow them to basically find their own set of information, you can build a very user-rich information by allowing them to register for the services and information that they may be interested in. I can log in as Bernard, a member of the environment, and I can start personalizing the site and bringing forward the relevant information for Bernard. If I go into my account, you can have registration services where people can enter information. Of course, adhering to your A, security policy, and B, your privacy policy. The state of California is doing this, and I believe the state of Oregon, where you can register for example, different online services. So the actual end user, you provide benefit by providing them the information and the relevant sites, but also allowing them to select which sets of information they may be interested in, such as My Online Services, news and event feeds that will be proactively presented to them, once again providing them the ability to personalize the different sets of features. Through using different types of technologies and paradigms, you can also give them the ability to personalize the presentation and look and feel. For example, change their colors, specify whether they want a calendar or not, or the different sets of information. So for example, if you can adjust fonts, senior citizens may be more interested in having a site that has larger fonts, where different users can tailor the presentation and the set of information that they may be interested in viewing when they come on your site. So based upon my user profile, I've set up some defined links, for example, on what Bernard, a member of the Oregon community, may be most interested in. A set of links that, based upon my preferences within the environment, any organization can set up feeds to provide them with the relevant information. For example, Bernard may be interested in the latest lottery information. I can come online there. I may also have reminders based upon events and support full e-commerce and transaction. For example, my child support is due. I am married, by the way, so this is fake. I made this up. Where I have a given beneficiary. They live in Portland, by the way, too, so that's my in-laws. The beneficiary, the amount, and a user can come on and start conducting transactions. Now, transactions could span the entire portal or any single organization. So I may, for example, want to pay my child support. I'm being proactively notified that my Volvo registration is due. Hunting licenses are now available since I'm an avid hunter, and I have a tax payment due on April 16th, where I can come in and once again from multiple areas, for example, from the child support area, tax payment, or for example, even the fishing and game, where I can come in and set up or register for my hunting license and buy now and pull multiple products and services and conduct a single transaction that is, can be conducted across multiple organizations. Now with Blue Martini, once again, we also have the ability to link information to other sets of information. For example, news feeds. I pulled in, I'm interested in the NCAA, so I pulled in some information regarding the Final Four. But once again, it provides the end user the ability to proactively define which information sources and services they're more interested in. In the general web world, there's kind of the 80-20 rule, which is 80% of your users are going to use 20% of your pages. Through using technologies such as prediction in terms of what people are going to be using and allowing people to specify what they're most interested in, you can get people to the information and services providing benefit much quicker. You can also set up different areas within Blue Martini where you may want to have your own legislation area, and allow people to come in and interact with different members of your organization through automated email settings and allowing them to proactively enter information and notes and collaboratively develop this site within Blue Martini. So that's just a quick, once again, demonstration of what I've done in Blue Martini application platform, our enterprise application platform, by taking information, content, different areas of your websites and pulling them into the infrastructure, integrating them into a portal environment where a user can very quickly get to the set of information that they are looking for. In addition, register to provide services and feeds so that they could define the own set of information they're looking at, the format that they would like to appear, and even the frequency of desire. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Any questions? No questions?
No questions.
Opportunity for an enterprise-wide solution. Make your tax payment, child support, and buy a hunting license all in the same transaction.
All right, now wait a minute. Okay, here we go. I got questions. Where's that thing that I was suggesting to you, Rob?
Your paper.
Yeah, I guess so. I think
better bring the Chief Justice up at the same time.
Yeah.
It Chief, is.
Chief, what a, how about...
For all the members.
I think it would be fun to see an online justice pilot project where there might be pro se tutorials on
creating dissolution documents, child support calculations, mm-hmm. initiation of a child support hearing, mm-hmm. visitation hearings, forcible entries and detainers, FAP orders, and traffic cases, mm-hmm. just to see if those things could be resolved online, entry of pleas, for example, mm-hmm. and perhaps have a little public libraries be an access point for teleconferencing to attend a hearing that way. I think it would be interesting to see if that would work in one jurisdiction or in a rural part of Oregon.
What's an interesting component of the Blue Martini software is they do have the ability is that it, for the collaborative where if a person is online and seeking assistance, you can go to a help center, and the help center can take control of somebody's computer remotely and lead them to the information they're looking for. So in terms of an opportunity and sort of saying, help me, I'm searching for X, someone could help them through transactions remotely all while they're online.
So there could be a clerk in the courthouse that could sit there and lead them through the or to the documents that they need.
Correct.
Or answer their specific questions. Or there could be a traffic court mm-hmm. magistrate sitting there having a chat with these folks and hearing their stories and giving them a solution to their problems.
Correct.
Yeah. And then they could pay online, too, wouldn't they?
There you go. Assess mm-hmm. the plan and get it all done.
Yeah, well, it staggers the imagination.
There was two questions in there. One is the ability to collaborate, and yes, mm-hmm. that is completely available in terms of having two people simultaneously browse and have a chat session so you can walk them through the process of finding sets of information. You know, when people do have problems with computers, they generally do, you know, call up somebody. With Blue Martini, you could click a button, synchronize browsers with the person on the other line, and then you could train that user how to effectively use your website. The second aspect of that is the ability to relate different sets of content with other pieces of content based upon usage. You may notice that different users are navigating into, for example, fill out specific forms and ending up at a dead end. That may be an opportunity to use some, once again, proactive predictive analytics that will link registration forms with how-to manuals and other sets of information. So when Bernard goes in there and would like to register for something, but I'm not quite knowledgeable, I'll have a related set of links that will guide me through, for example, how to register. Please call here in order to facilitate the registration. It cannot be done online. That's a very powerful way, because when you organize content and information, it's generally done by an individual who has a view of content from their own personal perspective, because they're the ones who basically write the content, versus how an actual user will use the end content. Users may use the content in different ways than originally intended, and predictive analytics can help with that to tailor your site to get them to the information quicker.
Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question, too, and the EDS people are still here, so I throw this out to both sets. I mean, you're both consultants. You both provide enterprise-wide solutions for governments, business, and everything else. And I don't know if you were here earlier when I guess I raised the question to DAS IRMD mm-hmm. and to Mr. Berkman and Vince Giappetta, who were here earlier, but my concern is as we move forward to adopt these enterprise-wide solutions, what are the stumbling blocks in terms of systemic stumbling blocks that you feel should be eliminated if you were to look at state government? Mm-hmm. I see substantial problems, mm-hmm. and I want to know if I'm all wet or if you would agree with me, because I know that, you know, on the private side of the house, you know, a lot of times you have power invested in a CIO, so the decisions can be made rather rapidly and content can be made as well. We don't necessarily have all those luxuries. By the same token, I like to have somebody with full authority and credit to be able to accomplish some of those tasks. And I'm wondering, in the projects that you've been involved with, has that been a problem, specifically government projects? But otherwise, what are the biggest systemic barriers that you see when you come in to do an enterprise-wide consulting project like is being proposed to do e-government? And I'd invite the EDS people, I guess, to back up as well if one of you wants to answer.
Okay. Chairman Hill.
Representative Partridge. That was a excellent question. I did catch it because we're very sensitive to that. And I think as Bernard and I were, you know, talking about the state of Oregon and governments in general, that question is something that looms in our mind. What we found to be effective in e-commerce related or e-business related endeavors is to have somebody who has the authority and responsibility to deliver. This is an application that is on the other side of the firewall that does interact with constituencies, and it is not behind a phone line and being an enterprise-wide or an ERP type of an application or even a CRM application. So, yes, we have found that there is less risk in both cost and delivery of vision if there is a centralized person with the authority and responsibility to deliver.
CRM, relationship management. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wish I understood the question that you just asked, let alone the answer that you just gave.
My question is, in their view as a consultant who has done government as well as private sector projects, what are the systemic problems or organizational barriers or silo barriers?
What do we have to fix first?
What do we have to fix first in order to? What can we as a legislature, I guess, help fix first in order to utilize your software or your consulting services or whatever? To what would you like to see as you turn the key to walk in the door to?
Or how do we
provide consulting services? You know, what systemic problems can we help solve?
And the answer can't be sole sourcing contracts. So.
It can't be.
No.
Chairman Hill, Representative Partridge. Clearly, you have honed in on one of the key issues to implementing any changes or any new solution enterprise across an entire enterprise. And I won't kid you, I won't pretend that it is easier that EDS or any other consultant or vendor can come in and make this issue go away. However, there is an aggressive marketing campaign that you must do internally, which you are doing. Representative Hill has set it in motion here today, but buy-in is critical. So when we go into an organization and begin a consulting project, we spend a great deal of time trying to understand whose initiative this is and at what level it exists, and understanding what that message is. And if the message is not high enough within the organization, we spend time encouraging and driving that message up in the organization so then it comes back down, and that everything you do, every initiative you undertake is focused on a single corporate governor's message, Chairman Hill's message. So it has to start at the top, and is you will go through a marketing campaign, but buy-in, you cannot do this without buy-in. So that has to be built in both into the time frame that you have set aside for this, and there have to be dollars allocated to this. It will not bring up a website. It will not, provide the security. It will not roll out the applications, but it will get the buy-in that you need, and there is no question that that is where you need to start, and you're going to have to get that buy-in. Now, however, this is kind of an old term, process reengineering or change management, but I think I continue to fall back and use those terms because I'm very familiar with them and I've seen it happen. But their change is painful, and what we do often is come in and try to find what the win-win is in a situation. The win-win to your agencies who have existed as silos or their own fiefdoms is that they will then have additional time and monies to allocate to their areas of expertise. And they have to come to you with a plan of what their real strategies and goals are. And in conjunction with that, what you would do then is be able to supply them with support and additional funding, because you have now centralized your platforms, your processing. Take email. I think that Representative Hill commented that you have
Seventy-two separate
email protocols, which is, in an organization like EDS, that would be a showstopper. I know that I can go out in any minute and broadcast to my team information, and everyone can read the information that I broadcast. And that's critical for us moving forward, because we have projects that have, you know, very strong, you know, very clear due dates. So that alone, that standardization will save a tremendous amount of time for you and your agencies, and time and money and effort, and make their lives a lot easier. But that's just a very minor example. So you have to provide the win-win. You have to, you know, show them where the value is, and vice versa. They have to step up to the table and take responsibility for their agencies in creating those. So I hope that answers. You said you've mentioned it, I would say, about 8 times today. And I think it's valid. I think it's critical. And I think you're focused on the right issue, because you have to have that kind of support and commitment across the board. But people have to know that there will be change. But change can be good.
Any further questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time and effort to come down. And thank you for putting together a picture of what it could look like. I think it's helpful to try to paint the picture of what can be. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Ross, you want to come up? And I want to thank HP there for coming today and bringing the equipment that they're demonstrating. Come on up, Bill. I want to thank, in terms of their partner, CompuCom and Quest and Department of Transportation and Department of Employment, in terms of the demo and stuff. I think this is just sort of trying to get a picture of what the world can be. But one of the things I wanted Bill to take an opportunity and talk about is the central operating environment and the concept of changing how the state might look at purchasing desktop systems. So
okay. I'm losing my voice somewhat, but my name is Bill Ross. I'm with Hewlett-Packard out of Boise, Idaho. Many weeks ago, we met with Representative Hill to talk about the value of standardizing on hardware, software, operating system, and so on. In most enterprises, we find that there's sometimes too much autonomy given to different organizations to basically do what they want. And so at one point at HP, there were 3 different word processors, 3 different PowerPoint types of presentation applications, Excel spreadsheet and any other spreadsheets, and one couldn't read the other or accommodate all of the more advanced features of the other presentation program. And so finally we had to come to a point where we said, let's standardize on software, let's standardize on hardware as well. The support side, when you have 100 different configurations for a desktop possibilities, there are, it's endless in how many different technicians you need to support all of those. When you standardize on a smaller number, whether it's 3 different laptops, 3 different desktop units, or 3 different high-end power user type of configurations, it allows the help desk to drive the costs down, because they become very fluent in the language of each of those configurations. They're able to work around any of the problems. They can quickly resolve them. We save a great deal on cost of support, as well as just the users being able to automatically know that they have everything compatible. The virus scan software is automatically updated whenever there's a new revision. We have a number of things that allow great savings to the enterprise.
Questions?
Well, a comment. I agree that standardization of the hardware and the software is probably key to making an enterprise system work statewide. I bet you, Mr. Chair, you never thought I would be able to say something like that.
Wow.
I'm surprised at myself. And they all moved away. What is bugging me is that I serve on judiciary, and we're doing what we can to standardize a lot of systems and help states communicate with one another, particularly in the parole and probation supervision area. The feds are requiring us to adopt a new standards, and hidden and tucked away in that provision, that big interstate compact contract that we're supposed to sign up, is a requirement that we be information technologically compatible with other states, at least in the transmission of this information. I think that the plot is to make us all standard. So what information can you give us about what other states, particularly other states in this region, are doing to standardize, and what standards are they adopting? That's a conversation that we really need to have.
Okay, that's a great question. Actually, most of the other states are in the same situation. They are finding that it's so expensive to support a non-standard environment that they are now trying to come to agreement on what should be the standard. So it is a somewhat painful process, because it means some of the people won't get what they are comfortable with, what they've used in the past, and they're going to have to learn something new. But typically, when you move to a certain standard, you move to that particular hardware platform or software application because it is the best that you've been able to study, research, and when you bring that, most of the users should readily move over to the new standard. Now, who has actually done that? We've done that at HP. There are a number of enterprise accounts that we work with that have done that. In government, I don't know of any state government at this point that is just specified this is what everyone will use. Typically, each department or agency, they standardize, but it's not necessarily compatible with a different department. Now, I don't think there's any national process in place to standardize on a set of software packages that would allow all the states to be compatible, but we could probably give some pretty good recommendations as to what the most likely software applications would be. I hesitate to say just Microsoft's Office suite. That seems to be what most states and most enterprises are standardizing on. That's not necessarily a recommendation, but that is the direction most have been going.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Again, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming out, and thank you to your son for coming out and taking control of that display. Thank you to Prison Industries for the furniture that is displayed back here. That's they brought that so we can see what they're doing. Again, to the Department of Transportation, the Employment Division, and all the vendors who came out today. Appreciate it. And without any further business before the committee, we are adjourned.